thank you. And actually, kind of on the activism note, I hope you don't mind me sharing the kind of story of how I came to be invited to speak here. So I think it was actually around this time, or the end of April last year, incoming sociology assistant professor Saida Grundy, here at Boston University, made some tweets regarding race and gender. And I'll come back to this a little bit. This isn't what my talk is about, but there's something that I say at the end about this. And the university published this letter, which I then wrote a piece critiquing. I was very angry about kind of the tone of their letter. So it's quite nice, actually, to come and speak at a university, which just a year ago I was criticising the administration. So I doubt that will happen again, you know.
Did the administration invite you?
The administration, right, precisely, do they know I'm here? No, so I'm very grateful
to be here. We need help here.
No, I'm very grateful to be here, though, and, you know, to kind of engage in these conversations. I'd be flattered if Christy sees as much of a connection between our talks as I did while listening to hers. Though mine is kind of very much an early project. It's not a polished piece yet. It's a work in progress, so any comments would be very helpful. I kind of wrote it with this panel in mind, in a sense. Good, okay. So I'll be looking at what's meant by explanation. So that's the sense in which I'll be talking about philosophy of science. But really, this is coming, you know, the kind of resistance aspect of it is really key. And this is really a talk about social epistemology. Okay. So just a few slides by way of introduction then. I'm kind of preaching to the choir here. This is all very kind of old stuff for most of you, I'm sure. So induction is our way of bringing a posteriori knowledge into our web of facts. We take singular observations, we cast them into regularities, we draw generalizations. And then we use explanation as a way of kind of accommodating those generalizations within what we think we already know, and systematizing that knowledge. So explanation kind of forms the link between the things we think we know. And I just want to start with a quote by Ray Langton, which I think points out a problem here, which I want you to bear in mind as we go through. So she says, things in the world are independent of us. And their behavior is constrained and determined by their natures. We can best discover those natures by looking for the regularities that reveal them in normal circumstances. In abnormal circumstances, things may be distorted. And the regularities we see may not reveal their natures. But the usual circumstances are the normal circumstances. So we should infer the nature of things from how things usually are. And the face that's being pulled at that, she's actually about to go on and critique this view. This is not her view, right? So she's critiquing this idea that we simply read off the things that we see in the world. And that's something that I want to critique here as well. And so what will come to mind for some of you is Elizabeth Anscombe's example of a shopper, somebody going shopping, going to the grocery store with a list and buying the things that she finds that she's written on the list, while a detective follows her, compiling a list according to the purchases that are made. So looking at the shopping trolley and writing out a list from that. So in one sense, you have a kind of word-to-world fit, and in the other sense, a word-to-word fit. Okay, so we've got these things going in two different directions. And so something to think about, again, to start with, is sometimes we're detectives, and sometimes we're shoppers, okay? So we act in both roles in the way that we deal with knowledge. And very often, more often than we would like for this to happen, our desires and beliefs construct an anomalous direction of fit in the world, okay? So rather than reading off the world, we're making things happen in the world and then reading them off as though they were there anyway, okay? So the world arranges itself, and this is Ray Langton perhaps saying something that would be more what you would expect her to say. So the world arranges itself, at least in part, to fit what the powerful believe. Believing women are subordinate, this is the example she uses, can make women subordinate. Thinking so can make it so when it's backed up by power. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little bit by way of introduction on that. And what I want to link that up to is that these anomalous directions of fit are actually relatively likely within our knowledge practices, because our knowledge practices are characterized by epistemic injustices. Okay, this is something that's come up already today. And I'm going to give a very brief, very unsophisticated overview of the kind of the basic framework that Fricker discusses in her book, that Miranda Fricker discusses in her book, Epistemic Injustice. So the idea here is that an epistemic injustice occurs when somebody is wronged in her capacity as a knower, okay, as distinct from other kinds of injustice. And it comes in two flavors, broadly speaking. Okay, we had, as I say, we had a much more sophisticated analysis, so I feel bad saying it comes in two flavors, and we had this kind of multi-level conceptual scheme already given to us. So Fricker speaks of testimonial injustice and hermeneutical injustice in that book, and I'll just go through what both of those mean. So testimonial injustice, then, is when a group of people, due to a structural prejudice, have their credibility as testifiers systematically deflated. They are not believed when they should be believed, okay? And it can happen both ways, of course. There are other groups of people who are systematically having their credibility inflated, okay? One example she uses in the book is doctors, all right? So doctors have this kind of spillover of credibility wherever they go in the world, and whatever topic they happen to be speaking on, you know, they're given this kind of credibility excess. And so the ideal of credibility is that we're just using it as a shortcut to work out how reliable testimony is, but as we've already heard, that shortcut goes wrong so often that it's not even clear that we're not doing a good job of it. So when a person's testimony is not trusted or taken seriously by virtue of a group to which that person belongs, rather than any fairer, and we can discuss what that might mean, fair assessment of a credibility, a testimonial injustice has occurred. Okay, so this is testimonial injustice, one kind. The other kind is a hermeneutical injustice. This did come up earlier. Very explicitly. So a group of people, due to a structural prejudice in the collective resources, the resources that we all use, the language that we use, the concepts that we use. So something is missing there. And as a result of that thing that is missing, a particular group of people is unable to understand their own social experience. Okay, and it's obscured from collective understanding, though, of course, they're the ones who get hurt by that, right? Even if we're all epistemically harmed in some way. So there's a paucity in these shared resources. Something's missing or skewed in the inventory of things we have, the vocabulary and concepts that we have. And Fricker says, I always like this quote, hermeneutical gaps are like holes in the ozone. It's the people who live under them that get burned, okay? Because we're all impoverished by them in some sense, but we're not all hurt by them, okay? So those are the two kind of types of epistemic injustice that I'll, bring up within this talk. Okay, but in the talk itself, I sort of want to do three things. So I want to look at ways in which, by deliberately refusing to understand on some occasions, we can kind of mitigate or push back against these epistemic injustices. And the way I'm going to go through that is I'm going to go through a kind of formal pragmatic conception of explanation, and it will become clear in a moment why I'm doing that, which kind of links up explanation and understanding. And I'm going to look at the kind of dynamic link, the relationship between the person who explains and the person to whom things are explained, okay? So how that relationship is configured. And I'm also going to look at a particular articulation already present in the literature of the refusal to understand. So I'm really taking that as a starting point and trying to build on that and maybe formalize it a little bit. As I say, this is early in the project, so there'll be lots of things that kind of need to be sharpened up. Okay, so section one, I'll actually start by looking at that paper. I'll then discuss what I mean by an explanation, a pragmatic view of explanation, and then I'll look at misunderstanding as a form of resistance. Okay. So to start with, then, strategic refusals to understand. So this is part of the title of this paper. Also, Gail Pohlhaas Jr. again coming up. So either by coincidence or because she's great. So this is a 2011 paper. It's actually very little known. It's not very very well known within the field, but it's a fantastic paper. And in this paper, what Paul House is trying to do is to question this assumption that we all have, that it is virtuous in some sense to try and understand one another. Okay? So if I start trying to say something, it is virtuous for all of you to kind of take a charitable view of that, to try to understand, to try to kind of go along with me within that, you know, the kind of mode of reasoning that I have adopted. And she wants to complicate that a little bit and kind of say, hang on, there are other situations where that could go wrong and where somebody could be being hurt by that. So where someone could be wronged by a request for understanding. So if I say, surely you understand this, or you must understand this, or to just explain something, that something could go wrong there. And so she asks whether it might be ethically and epistemically productive, in some cases, to refuse to understand. Okay? And it's this that I really want to take on here. So she uses two examples in her paper. So I'll read these quotes aloud. The first example is from The Alchemy of Race and Rights, a book by Patricia Williams. And Patricia Williams recounts how during debates in the 1980s about buzzer systems used by store owners in New York City, so this is people buzzing in order to get into stores, okay, so that people can kind of screen out particular groups. So during debates about this, there were repeated public urgings that blacks understand the buzzer system by putting themselves in the shoes of white store owners. That, in effect, blacks look into the mirror of frightened white faces for the reality of their undesirability. Okay? So that's one example. And the second example, also in Paul House's paper, in Susan Bryson's Aftermath, so that the book is a kind of reflection on Bryson's survival from sexual assault an attempted murder. And Susan Bryson writes, "When I started telling people about the attacks," this is the sexual assault and attempted murder, "I said simply that I was a victim of an attempted murder. People typically asked in horror, what was the motivation? Were you mugged? And when I replied, no, it started as a sexual assault, most inquirers were satisfied with that as an explanation. I would have thought that a murder attempt plus a sexual assault would require more, not less, of an explanation than a murder attempt by itself." Okay? So the idea here is that this is implicated in structures of knowledge where it makes sense somehow. You're like, oh, that's what was going on there, right? And so there's something problematic in both of these cases about the understanding that is going on or that is being asked for. Okay? And so Paul House says, persons are being called to understand something that only makes sense from within patterns and practices that hold oppressive power relations firmly in place and that actively prevent those asked to understand from calling attention to this fact. In these cases, demonstrating the harm that the requested understanding does can only be done from worlds that actively resist the sense of the world one has been implicitly asked to inhabit. From within it, you cannot resist it, okay? Something happens when you begin to accept these things as adequate ways of understanding the world, okay? So she wants to resist that. And going back to Patricia Williams, she says, if Williams were to approach the debate directly, understanding it on its own terms, she would have to consider herself as less than a full epistemic agent to begin, as one in the presence of whom it is reasonable to fear for one's life. From within such a world, it is hardly possible to call attention to the outrageousness of being asked to engage from that position. Asking Williams or any black American to understand the arguments of those who support racial profiling is to ask her to follow and subsequently maintain the sense of a context in which her agency, including her epistemic agency, is automatically curtailed for no good reason. Okay? So this is the point of this paper. As I said, it's a fantastic paper. So I just wanted to kind of pull that out to sort of set this thing. So what's at issue here is understanding. And I want to kind of see if I can push that a little bit further. Okay, so what do we mean by understanding? Well, understanding isn't equivalent to knowing, okay? And one way of characterizing that distinction is to state that understanding requires a person to be in possession of an explanation for something. But, you know, the distinction is clear, because we can't know we might know something without understanding it, and you might understand something without necessarily knowing its details. Okay, there is a distinction to be made there. And so what I want to ask is, might a refusal to understand be enacted as a refusal to accept an explanation for something? And if understanding occasions ethical and epistemic concern, is the same true of explanation? Okay, should we also be concerned about that? So really, I'm just sort of extending her project a little bit. So I'll start by asking what an explanation is. So what happens when we explain? What kind of things do we explain? What determines when an explanation has taken place? So this is just really straightforward philosophy of science now. So you've got your explanandum, explained by your explanants, okay? And I'm going to take a kind of Van Frossen-y kind of pragmatic view on all of this. I think it kind of captures our intuitions most reliably. So I'm going to kind of have a slight variant of that, which I've put together, which you know works independently in other contexts, but I think is especially fitting here. So explananda can be described as why questions, right? Involving contrast cases. So when we ask a question, what we really are doing is saying, when we ask for an explanation, what we're really saying is, why did this happen instead of these other things which might have happened, okay, in relation to whatever auxiliary assumptions we have? And obviously, with why questions, you end up with why regresses, right? So anyone who has, you know, has a small child or spent any time with a small child knows this very well, right? The why can go on and on and on, okay? You can give an answer and it can be why that, and you can keep going. So we can think of explananda as why questions. And then on this pragmatic view, to explain an event is to show that that event is expectable, okay? So given the particular circumstances and the laws in question, the occurrence of that phenomenon was to be expected, and it's in this sense that the explanation enables us to understand why the phenomenon occurred. So this is a game of probabilities, very straightforwardly. A good explanation raises or makes high its explanandum's probability, and the more it does so, the better it is. So where I want to take this then is to draw on some work by Paul Horridge and look at the way that surprise can be seen as a necessary condition for an explanatory demand. So then an explanatory demand arises when we find something surprising. Okay, so that's a necessary condition. That you find something surprising, then you have an explanatory demand, and then the explanation ends up making the thing seem less surprising than it did before. So that seems to capture what we do when we explain. All right? I'm not going to go into too much detail. It doesn't matter too much, but I will go. I'll talk a little bit about how this changes the probabilities. So Frank Ramsey says, what we mean by an event not being a coincidence or not being due to chance is that if we came to know it, it would make us no longer regard our system as satisfactory. Although in our system, the event may be no more improbable than any alternative. Okay. So the distinction that needs to be made here is this. If I take a penny and I flick the penny and look at which way it comes up. A penny is very English, isn't it? I just realised that. But anyway, if I flick a penny and I'm looking at it coming up heads or tails, okay? And I flip it over 1,000 times and it comes up heads every single time, right in front of you, here at the front. You'd be quite surprised by that, right? In fact, the probability of that happening is exactly the same as any other sequence of penny flips, right? If I get heads, tails, tails, heads, tails. Probability is always a half. These are independent events. Multiply all your halves together. The probabilities come out the same, okay? So you're surprised in one case and you're not in the other, right? And so something different is happening. So when we're surprised by something and when we think we need an explanation, it's not just that it's improbable. There's something more going on. This is what I'm calling surprise. This is a kind of formal version of surprise, not surprise in the kind of everyday sense. And so I'm borrowing the notion of surprise from Horridge here and drawing this into the kind of debate on explanation. So he says that an event is surprising if its probability is low and the probability of whatever background conditions you had conditionalized over that event is actually lower than the probability of the background conditions before that event. So the event makes you think that there's something wrong with your assumptions. When I flip that penny and it comes up heads 1,000 times, you've got to start thinking whether your assumption that the penny was fair is wrong, okay? So that's when we need explanations, when something has happened that makes us think that our assumptions are no good and are in need of revision. Okay? As I say, there's not a huge amount of hands on this, but I just wanted to show that there's a sort of formal basis for this. Okay, good. So I'm just kind of talking about this again here. I mean, in relation, I gave the penny example. You can also do this with lotteries. If a person wins a lottery which consists of a billion entrants, or wins three consecutive lotteries, each consisting of 1,000 entrants, the probabilities are exactly the same, right? But in the first case, you bought a lottery ticket, you won the lottery, fair enough. In the second case, you won three lotteries, something's going on, right? You would then think the person was cheating. You have no reason to believe that in the first case. Okay, so there's a distinction between being merely improbable and being surprising, and my claim here is that, you know, I think this notion of surprising captures what we need for an explanatory demand to be legitimate. Good, okay. So what ends up happening then is that explanation then consists of the revision to those background assumptions. So we start with some background assumptions. We have an explanatory demand which comes out of something being surprising. We accordingly revise our background conditions, and that is an explanation. Okay, that's what an explanation consists of. So an explanation is the revision to background assumptions in order to accommodate surprising facts. So it converts surprising facts into unsurprising facts by modifying some auxiliary assumptions. And this little formal bit is going to end in like two slides, and then we're back to talking about the sort of more interesting stuff. So, good, okay. But what comes out of this, and the reason why I kind of wanted to take this pathway, is that I think it encourages us to see explanation as something more than just descriptive, okay? So as philosophers of science, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about what explanations are, and here, what I want us to start thinking about is what explanations do, okay? So explanations as kind of a speech acts in the sense of Austin, you know, so as perlocutionary acts. When you explain something, you do something, all right? You do something in the world, and the thing that you do in the world is you reconfigure the background assumptions of the person who asked for the explanation, okay? And in doing so, you make the explanandum less surprising. And what this also tells us, so that's one thing, that you're doing something. The explanation is doing something. It's not me, you know, it's actually bringing about a change in the world. But also, one of the other things about explanation is an explanation can only be successful if the person to whom you have explained thinks it's successful. Okay? And that can only be adjudicated by that person. So the process of explanation then is kind of dialectical in a way. And the explainee, the person to whom you explain, has a certain power over that process, right? They can say, I don't understand, that's not good enough, you know? And so they're part of the process of giving an explanation. They don't merely passively receive an explanation. And so what this kind of points to, which is what I'll look at in the next section, is the sort of dialectic nature of this can be subverted, and we can subvert it in order to resist explanations that are marginalizing. Okay, so that's where I'm going with this in a very long-winded kind of way. Okay, so this is what that looks like, just to kind of put it into a picture. You have your surprising fact, which is your explanandum. It produces an explanatory demand, which can be expressed as a why question. You revise your auxiliary assumptions, and with any luck, it becomes an unsurprising fact and everything is fine in the world and you've explained. But if not, you then have to come back up here. The explanation itself might be surprising, okay? And you loop back around again, okay? Good. So that's the section on explanation. So now I want to just spend a little while talking about this idea of misunderstanding as a form of resistance. Okay. So the first thing to note, and this has already been done very well today, is that, you know, people are variably situated in the world. Explanation, as I've said, acts upon that world, and it's a very powerful act within the epistemic world as well. It reorders the way that our knowledge exists, each piece of knowledge exists in relation to every other, okay? So it's very powerful. But particularly situated knowers, those with privilege, hold a monopoly on the production of explanations. And that's both via the credibility that they have, but also the platforms that are available to them as well. While other knowers are situated to receive or repeat explanations, or and I'll talk about this on the next slide, or are excluded from this game of explanation altogether. Okay, they don't actively participate in the production of, they can't actively participate in the production of explanations. So, you know, knowers are never just individuals. So I've talked a lot about groups, you know. You understand a knower in relation to their group membership, to the groups to which that person belongs. And as we've already seen, those in privileged groups are readily assigned these credibility excesses, and those in marginalized groups are assigned credibility deficits. Okay? So in this game of explanation, not everybody is situated in the same way. And so as I said, it's a very powerful thing, and I think, you know, this idea of mansplaining that's come up a lot recently, which lots of us have experienced as well, you know, the anger that arises, the very legitimate anger that arises from that, I think kind of points to the power of explanation, to what explanation means to all of us, right? That it angers us so much when somebody kind of steamrolls over your explanation or takes credit for it, okay? Good, okay. So another thing to mention here is explanatory exclusion. So I've just kind of pulled out two facts that spring to mind here. So one thing is what authority does to exclude some people from the explanatory game, as I've called it. So extreme credibility differentials begin to foreclose the perceived utility of participating in an explanatory exchange, even just as an explainee, right? Not even producing an explanation, just receiving an explanation. So when you have a high credibility estimation of somebody, you tend to trust that person, right? And you may be compelled to understand what they say or to claim to understand what they say without ever having participated in an explanatory exchange. A good example of this, again, is doctors. So lots of studies, so I've done some work on informed consent, and lots of studies show that patients are actually not especially interested in the information that's given to them before they have a medical procedure or treatment, right? There's a lot of trust there, and even if they've glanced over the sheet, you know, they very rarely have any idea whatsoever of what has been done to them or is going to be done to them. So like, there's almost this kind of hopelessness around it. What, you know, I'm not going to understand anyway, but I trust you, so. So authority can kind of, you know, annihilate the explanatory exchange to some extent. And so can the fact that in certain cases, and this is linked, certain individuals, authoritative individuals, or certain very obscure fields of study are also exclusive. And I say by either accident or design, okay? So people are locked out of understanding because their understanding is obfuscated. There's not a possibility of understanding. The language is too complicated. The ideas are too complicated, or they're perceived to be. And nobody is trying to make them not that way. Nobody's trying to remedy that. So academia is a good example of this. We often choose to speak in ways that exclude people, even when we could speak in other ways, okay? But one thing that strikes me as being particularly important here is politics and economics, okay? So obviously, you know, now is a very exciting time in the politics and politics in the US, but I'd be very surprised if sort of an average person on the street has much idea of what's at stake or what's really going on. And I've got the kind of Brexit thing going on here, so Britain leaving the European Union at the moment, this will have huge consequences. One way or another, most people in the UK have absolutely no idea what is going on, and we are having a referendum on it. So they are being asked to vote directly on this decision, and no one is really seeking to understand. So there's something going on there in terms of things are made sufficiently obscure, right? And I think a lot of that is by design, okay? I think it helps certain groups if people don't understand what's going on. Science is another one as well, okay? Okay, so what I want to talk about now is something that I've sort of theme I've called explanatory injustice, a working term for this, but it draws on testimonial hermeneutical injustice. So as I've said already, you need an element of surprise. You need surprise to be present in order to have an explanatory demand. And in order to have surprise, you need to have improbability coupled with the fact that that phenomenon will be more probable if conditioned over new or different auxiliary assumptions. So occasions of marginalization then are apt to provoke surprise, okay? And that might surprise you that I'm saying that in a way, but they're obviously part of the daily operative reality of the lives of so many, but they seem improbable because according to our collective manifest understanding of the world in which we live, which is supposed to be equal, meritocratic, you know, a fair world, a world where everyone has a clear shot at doing well for themselves, which, as I say, is only a manifest understanding, it's not the operative one. But it is produced and sustained by the privileged, who have a monopoly over you know, knowledge as a whole. And it is true for them, okay? So this is their truth, and it's a truth that is forced on all of us, and that most of us internalise in some way, so that it strikes us as surprising that bad things can happen in this world. As I said, so this explanatory injustice combines both testimonial and hermeneutical injustice. So what's going on here consists of both of these. So privilege grants an explanatory monopoly to certain groups, that's the testimonial injustice, so that the explanations which are most determinative of our social realities are curated by those in power, and then they're distributed as communal resources for all of us to understand our social world. And that ends up obscuring the experience of so many of us, okay? And there's the hermeneutical injustice. I'll say a bit more about this on the next slide. So it's not that explanatory injustice is the construction of outright falsehoods. It's not that people are inventing explanations out of thin air. It's not even that they're violating the rules of explaining, as I just described them, right? They're playing by the rules, but they are warping the explanatory process. This process is continually distorted by structural forces, either deliberately or completely accidentally, okay? Just as part of ordinary life. And I think that this typically occurs through two demarcations within our practice of explaining, which, as I've pointed out, is highly subjective, okay? Our process of explaining is highly subjective. We don't give objective explanations. It's not possible to do so in almost all of the cases that we consider to be important. And I think two of the most important subjectivities here are where the explanation stops along the Y chain. So where we stop it, when do we stop asking why? When do we go, oh, that's the explanation, and you can't go one step back. And the other thing is where the explanation reaches in terms of its context. Where does it go in the world of facts? What domains are appropriate for what explanation? And this is key, this is extremely important, because if you consider things like, so in the UK at the moment in universities we have something called the Prevent Agenda, which some of you may have heard of. So there is a responsibility on academics like myself to report unusual or suspicious activity by Muslim students, okay? So this is something that has been asked of us by the government, and they're doing this kind of tour where they're going around to universities to talk to people, make sure they're aware that they have a responsibility to do this for high schools as well, primary schools even. They've already had several like little kids who've been questioned by police. There was one who was writing a story about a cucumber, and they read it as cooker bomb and brought him in, and you know, so you're already hearing of examples of people being brought in. So the idea here is, you know, the explanation that would be given is, well, look at all these violent attacks. Who's doing, you know, who's perpetrating these violent attacks? Come on, we've got to be clever about this. It's this group of people. These people are dangerous. And so it's how far do you push that? Because what you don't want to do is simply deny the existence of these attacks to which they refer, right? But there's obviously a whole load of explanations that back that up, and context that takes it outwards as well. So again, going back to the example of women as superficial or submissive, okay? You know, you can have a look at the global cosmetics industry, right? Or you can have a, you can observe the behavior of women as a whole, and you can draw all sorts of conclusions about that. But if you don't push out in terms of context, and if you don't push back in terms of histories, you're not going to get to the bottom of anything, okay? So we have these truncations which occur in our explanatory chains, and they're very persuasive, these truncated explanations, because they favour the immediate and the particular over the distant, the complex, and the structural, okay? It makes sense to people. You go, why, you know, why are we scared about these people? Because of such and such thing. And they'll be like, well, I can't deny the reality of that thing, you know? You start pushing it further and telling people, you know, certainly about structural things. And this goes back again to, you know, colonialism, right? So most people's understanding of most of the global South is that there's a lot of poverty and corruption. And it's very rarely in the news or anywhere else pushed any further to look at colonial histories. And to look at the drawing up of borders and to understand where that came from. And in many cases, people actively see that as you're going off the point, you know? We've got to stay focused here, right? And so there's this kind of tyranny of the face value, almost, in the way that we give explanations. And while the truncation may not be false, and in many cases it is not false, somebody has observed a generalization and they are stating that generalization. So the truncation, there's nothing false about what they're saying, but the truncation contains an implicature, right? It implies something which is false, okay? So it's a little more complicated than to just say that they're wrong. And so as I said, poverty, racism, sexism, lots of experiences of marginalization can qualify as surprising because they seem improbable with respect to the background assumption of a world which very does an excellent job of disguising structural injustice, okay? And then there's a, you know, and the other criteria here is there's another set of auxiliary assumptions with respect to which they seem more probable. So the question then is, what are those auxiliary assumptions? How should we revise our understanding of the world? And at face value, it seems like, great, here's our chance to say our piece, right? The reason that these things happen is because we live in a world that, you know, patriarchal, white supremacist, capitalist world. That's why these things happen, right? So we've got the obvious explanation. Except that in reality, as I've already said, the modification to the auxiliary assumptions are explanations that get truncated in a way that maintains the privilege that in the first place disguised the injustice. And so we end up saying something like, that ends up being equivalent to there being some kind of deficiency in that group of people. Something undeserving about that group of people that makes them have this experience. And so this marginalization is normalized by the process of explanation and made more invisible than it was before. And worse, in many cases, the explainee participates in that normalization, right, through this dialectic, okay? Which is not to assign blame here, but just to talk about the way this is all bound up and gets internalized. I won't spend too long on this, but just to say that, you know, there's almost an issue of consent here. And when you accept an explanation, you give your consent to the revision of your background assumptions in response to that explanation. But if we refuse to understand, okay, if we refuse to accept an explanation, we don't grant our consent, the perlocutionary act is thwarted, the auxiliary assumptions don't occur, the explanatory demand remains. We ask, sorry, no, that's not good enough. What do you really mean? What's the explanation? And you push it further. And so when you reject the explanation, you maintain the explanatory burden and you push it further. And the rejection might be an outright refusal to accept the revision that you've been given to your background assumptions, or it might be that you convert it into a new why question. So you say, I get it, many of these attacks in Europe are being carried out by groups who claim to be Islamic. Why? Let's talk about why. Can we put that as the new explanatory demand and see where that takes us? And more than anything, I mean, what that means is and that can go one of two ways. You can end up having a productive conversation where you push someone to exploring their assumptions, or you can end up forcing someone to say something out loud that is racist. right? And that's really productive, actually, right? Because they hear it themselves, and they may hear it themselves for the first time, okay? To hear themselves say that and go, oh, you know, and feel the, I mean, I doubt that really happens, but, you know, the possibility is there at any rate. And so these why questions are calling points on this chain of explanations, but not all of these calling points are equal, and without critical reflection, a truncated explanation can end up implying naturalness. So to go back to Ray Langton's quote, in abnormal circumstances, things may be distorted, and the regularities we see may not reveal their natures. Okay, so it's this naturalness issue that can become the problem here. And so, this misunderstanding that I'm kind of claiming can be a method of resistance is not, I mean, I use misunderstanding in the title, and actually I don't like that as a word here, because what's happening is this would not be a failure to understand, right? We all understand perfectly well, okay? I grew up in a very working class area of Essex in the UK, and I understand why my school friends were racist. I do understand. I wish I didn't, but I do understand. I understand their reality. What's going on here is a deliberate socio-epistemological maneuver, okay? So this is a kind of performative thing. The listener is capable of understanding, right? Because we can all take on these assumptions, but doesn't want to. And so I'm calling it disunderstanding, this deliberate misunderstanding, where you feign ignorance. And you demand an interrogation of an explanation, extending the why regress back in time and outwards in context, and you can guide that by the questions that you ask, okay? And more than that, this disunderstanding, this deliberate refusal to understand, in being performative, need not be verbal, okay? It could also be a form of civil disobedience. So if you think about Rosa Parks, sitting in a particular area of the bus, what she was doing in that case, or what you could interpret her as doing, is refusing to understand the racist rules concerning the use of public transport. I refused to understand, and that act was her refusal to understand. Equally, you could look at queering your performance of gender as a deliberate refusal to understand a sex gender binary, okay? Okay, so yeah, many ways to enact this explanatory resistance. You can be surprised where others are not surprised. You can be surprised where others are surprised, right, as well. You can extend a why regress, or you can just outright reject the revision to the auxiliary assumptions that's been offered to you, which might not be the same thing. And so you can intervene at various points in this cycle. And I think this is the final slide then. So to conclude then, understanding is not always epistemically or ethically virtuous, okay? But I've linked it to explanation. So understanding is best understood as being obtained via explanation. And since explanations are subjective and linked to power, and are also dialectical, they require the participation of the explaining, and that's a point for the subversion, okay? If you're part of that process, you can subvert it. So as such, there's an epistemic and ethical duty to resist marginalizing explanations, to disunderstand, in order to force the conspicuousness and interrogation of marginalizing epistemologies. And this is already happening. So we're all on one side of this, but there is another side. I'm not going to claim that the resistance practice that I've just described belongs only to those of us who are anti-racist and feminist and all the rest of it. This is one of Saida Grundy's tweets from this time last year, I think it was April 22nd or something. So she says, why is white America so reluctant to identify white college males as a problem population? I think we all understand what she means by that, and we can see the problems which she's pointing to when she says that. But those right-wing students who decided to make an issue for her out of this decided to misunderstand in a particular way, and suddenly this charge of reverse racism and reverse sexism was being thrown around. And so they were enacting what I have just described, a refusal to understand her on her own terms here. And so, you know, it's happening from one side. So it would be good if it was happening more. I mean, it is already, but it would be good if it was also happening from the other. And that's all. Thank you.